accession number 4768, roll number 2.
Mr. Wensworth, reel 2.
Imagine the toilet seat laid on the floor, which would leave a shape like that, as compared with the toilet. That had to be cemented. There were no fires allowed on the night before the billet inspection, and in the middle of the winter, Manston could be very, very cold. You weren't allowed a fire because the stove had to be black-leaded. The coke bin on top had to be really bright. We used to put all the beds in the centre for polishing purposes. The beds, incidentally, were the mattress was three biscuits, that we call them, three squares. So we used to get one on the floor on top of a blanket, and having put the polish on, we used to scoot up and down, three or four of us pulling it, with a couple of airmen sat on it to polish it. And we had one airman whose bed space we did for him so that he could tell us dirty jokes. And he could tell us dirty jokes forevermore. He'd been a steward on a, well, it wasn't the Queen Mary, but something similar.
When you say the coke had to be bright, you mean this was a regulation that the coke had to be bright?
Not the coke, the bin that the coke came in.
Oh.
The coke that the bin, it stood on top of that stove, you'll see.
And when you did the cementing, can you describe how you did that?
Well, with a whitewash brush. And it was a small amount of cement put in a bucket, thinned down with water. So it was a creamy colour when you'd finished.
But so you were just putting a thin veneer of cement on the cement that already was there?
That's right. Just bull. Nothing short of bull. And it applied to everything. There's a lot of things I didn't understand about the RAF. That, to me, is, I would not term as discipline. I would term that as sheer bull. Mind you, kit inspections were a necessary evil, although they don't have them now, billet inspections as well, because such was the airmen that, had they not been inspected now and again, I dread to think what they'd been like. It was a day you had to leave your bed tidy and such like. You was no leaving your bed down. You had to be folded up daily, and your sheets and blankets made into a certain pattern. But you watch that billet on a Sunday. Terrible. I'd sit round the fire talking how many pints they'd had on Saturday nights, rake a few ashes out, spit in the rest of it, put some more coke on and rake it out again so that you got ashes that. And there were airmen who would have let it go to that standard. Well, this is where I disagreed.
But did you ever say to the NCOs, this is all bull, you know, why do we have to do this?
You don't do that. No, that was out. You accepted it. You just got to accept it.
But did you grumble amongst yourselves?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I say, especially in a winter time when you started after tea, inspections at Manston, and I remember they were always on a Tuesday night. As soon as ever you'd got your tea, you went back to your billet and you started working, and you were working till lights out, which was 10 o'clock. You were up earlier than you were normally to finish off, and everything had got to be absolutely as per. Now, I've told you about the punishment I got. The only other charge I was on, and it didn't wash, I drove into the hangar in a Leyland lorry, and I was wrong. I took it out of gear and coasted in, and a corporal came across to me, and he said, you're speeding in that hangar. So I said, I beg your pardon, corporal. I said, I will admit to being wrong. I coasted in. Well, I say you were speeding. Well, I said, I'm sorry, corporal, but I beg to differ. You had to be polite, but you were allowed to say that. So he said, and take that smile off your face. So I said, I'm not smiling, Corporal. Well, I say, you are smiling. I said, no, Corporal, I've got a pleasant countenance. So he said, I said, if you think I'm smiling, I think you should put me on a charge. He said, I am doing for wearing civilian gloves. Well, that didn't hold water. I couldn't drive in woolen gloves. They slipped on the wheel. So I appeared before next morning before a warrant officer, and that told me that the charge wasn't going any further than him. It just they just didn't have taken me, and you're charged with wearing civilian gloves.
Why did it tell you that? Why did it tell you that, the fact that it was a warrant officer?
Well, the warrant officer could not charge you. He could not punish you. It had to be an officer. So anyway, this warrant officer said, you are the man that wears civilian gloves. Now, I'm looking for a man that wears civilian gloves to polish my office this afternoon. Now, this was Wednesday, and Wednesday in the services in those days was sports afternoon. Well, it so happened that Wednesday morning was also inspection day on the lorries, and the officer inspecting was not satisfied with the cleanliness, so everybody went back to work and cleaned the vehicles. I polished the warrant officer's office. I went and watched a football match. I went back to the billet and had a bath, and the airmen were still cleaning their vehicles, so that was my punishment. I'd got away without any damn thing. That's the sort of thing that happens.
Do you think the warrant officer did that deliberately?
Oh, no. He didn't know at that period that every other airman was going back to work. The inspection took later in the morning. But it was rather funny that this corporal that had charged me, he went out of the services. And then when, during the war, he came back as a reservist. And he arrived at a storage park, which I'll explain later, to collect a vehicle from me. Now, normally he would have collected that vehicle within 10 minutes, but I shouldn't think he knew till the end of his days why he found himself waiting all day. I recognised him and he didn't recognise me. So it was naughty of me, but I just couldn't resist it. Right, I think that's the end of Manston.
You're comparing Digby, the discipline at Digby, with Manston. Did you find that the discipline was less strict at a squadron than...
Probably a little bit less, a little more lax, put it that way. Once your schooling days were over, like Uxbridge and Manston, you got onto a normal station. There was still discipline, but not quite so strict. I think the only time I was checked was because I had a pocket in my back of my putty. I'll explain that. When you put on your pantaloons and putties, there had to be a certain number of shoelaces, cross shoelaces showing, might be six. There had to be about 8 rings in each putty. It had to finish on that little bone there.
Just to the side of your knee?
That's right. Well, now, the first time you ever put on a putty, it was sheer luck where you started. And you'd end here. So you work that out, and if I move it round a certain distance, it will matter. But it didn't. It took me half an hour to get those putties on the first time I ever wore them. You got used to that, and you remembered where to start. And I got checked on a church parade once for having a pocket in the putty. It hadn't laid level. This is the sort of trivialities again. But I got on fairly well with everybody, and I say especially with the sergeant. Well, Digby, as I say, was driving. You collected stores from the station, you delivered coal to the married quarters and wherever it was needed. You picked up families from the nearby railway station and all this kind of thing. And the hook starter. General work, nothing outstanding, nothing unusual. Well, then, in 19, 1933, they called for volunteers, which was an annual thing, for volunteers for armoured cars. Now, three of us volunteered. Two got it, one was colourblind. And it was necessary for various equipment, which I'll explain when we get to armoured cars, for you to know colours. However, Digby closed down. This is one of the things I can never understand. I've been told that by a civilian miles away that Digby was closing down. But prior to it closing, there was two new warrant officers' quarters built that were never occupied. There was a new petrol pump put in the MT yard, which never had any petrol in it. The airfields were not concrete runways then. There was a tarmac apron in front of the hangars, and the rest was grass. That was all re-tarmacked. Every hangar, every building was painted, and then they just closed it down. Of course, 2 years later, it opened up again. But this is the way the wonders of... It was all right. It took some understanding from Air Ministry down, as I'll tell you a few things. So, Digby closed. A pal and myself were kept behind for 3 months on a maintenance party. We cleared all the vehicles away. The last two went to Hendon on our way up to London, Henlow rather. And then we went down to Eastchurch on the Isle of Sheppey on our armoured car course.
Why did you decide to go in for armoured cars?
A high pay rate. You automatically volunteered for overseas, and I fancied overseas then. I wasn't married, of course.
Why were you attracted to overseas?
I want to see the world. That was the only reason. I could think of nothing else.
How much better was the pay on armoured cars?
Massive. It went from 12 shillings or 14 shillings a week to 21 shillings a week. But the big thing was that when you passed an exam in armoured cars, you were automatically reclassified or promoted, whichever the case may be. From AC1 to LAC was reclassified. From LAC to corporal and beyond was promoted. That was the difference. So, nothing very... Again, swindles. A corporal came round with the coke lorry. And it was those bins that are shown there. He said, "Now, boys, I can assure you that it's very, very cold at Eastchurch in the winter. All you're entitled to is 2 skips per week of coke." He said, "It's just not enough. So, if every airman is readily, he will give me a tuppence a week, I'll make sure you get 2 extra bins of coke." 3 years later, I found we're entitled to 4 bins. And we'd been paying him tuppence a week to get them. He got found out in the end, and I don't know what happened to him, but I met him. On our cars, he came out there.
Coming back to how you were selected for armoured cars, how were you chosen? Did you have to pass an exam? Or
no,
what?
No. Medically fit was the main thing. We could all drive. That was obvious. But there was nothing else. I say that, and the medical included colour blindness, and if you'd been colour blind, you were just out. Well, it was only a short course, about, 3 months. The CO there, incidentally, was at that time Group Captain Tedder, who eventually became Lord Tedder. But you didn't get much to do with station commanders. Incident there, when I eventually left Eastchurch, I went to, I can't remember the name of the station, we had 2 kit bags, and I wanted the kit bag handle made with so I could put a lock on it. So I went to our local blacksmith, and he got a bucket handle and a blooming piece almost like a poker through the middle, far too big, and walking along this Sittingbourne was the station. The bucket handle spread, all my kit came out on the platform. There's a sergeant there shouting and bellowing at me, the train was ready to move off. These are all the funny little incidents. Well, the next thing was troop ships. To me, they were disgusting. They were the old Bibby line, the Devonshire and the Dorsetshire and the other shires. I did two trips on the Dorsetshire. They were smelly. They were cramped. You slept in hammocks. They were anything but pleasant. I never did enjoy them. Well, in my early days, I'd been a chauffeur to a titled lady, and she was in a position to inquire about this, so I wrote to her, and she got a letter from the Air Minister, and he gave all the facts and figures of how many got on at Southampton, I suppose it would be, and how many got off at the first port of call, how many got on, and we could have carried another 200. Well, heaven help us if we'd have got another 200 of us. It really was terrible.
Why was it so bad?
I just don't know. A lot of army people, now I'm not against the army, but they were not as clean as the RAF, and they were definitely not as clean as the Navy. We used to like Navy people on the next mess table to us, and they were spotless, and you're all right. But I've seen orderly officers walk through those decks at late at night with their fingers to their nose because of the smell of sweaty feet and goodness knows what, sweaty bodies in general. I did not like troop ships. Another thing, and this always annoyed me, and it annoyed me when I got higher ranks, it wasn't because I happened to be an AC2 in those days. Every day there would be a daily bulletin, and it would tell you the entertainments that were to take place on there. Officers and their ladies, a cinema show, as an example. Warrant officers, senior NCOs, and their wives, a dance. Airmen and their women, a pillow fight. I never agreed with that. I mean, my wife, if I'd had one then, she's as much a lady as an officer's. He used to absolutely get me. And then you had to accept it.
Did this apply to other airmen as well, or was it just you who noticed that?
Oh, no, it was a general thing. They all noticed it. The cheeky beggars calling my wife a woman, whereas an officer was a lady. And they were on a higher deck than us, and they looked round. There was an inspection daily by the captain of the ship, and you were not allowed down below deck before he'd inspected it. And it was to pour with rain, and these officers' wives used to be up under an awning, just literally leering at us, leering. No, I didn't.
Leering in what way?
Well, look at those silly beggars out in the rain sort of style. No, I strongly objected it. Now, on that particular one, we had the Northumberland Fusiliers. Now, they'd been naughty. I think in Bermuda, they'd upset trams and taxis and they'd really gone wild. So, as a punishment, they were taken back to Southampton, but only three were allowed off the boat to get married, because they'd made arrangements to get married, and they've sailed again for another overseas station without being allowed home. Now, this was another disgusting thing. They brought trains down from Newcastle with these chaps' wives, and I've literally, under a gangway underneath the stairs, a man and wife with a pal hole in his overcoat. And you didn't have to think very deeply to find out what they were doing. It really was disgusting. And everybody noticed it. Well, eventually we arrived some 3 weeks later at Basra. We didn't know at that time where we were going, except that we were going to Iraq.
Which year was this?
This was 1934.
What were your impressions of Basra?
Let me run out. It was not 1934, it was 1932. I'm looking this up a little bit.
It was That's all right.
It was 1934, as I said originally. Your question?
What were your impressions of Basra? What impression did
well,
it make?
Well, it wasn't there long enough. It was just our port. The impressions I got when I got on the train were altogether different, although we were to find worse. But you were crammed on those things. They were like cattle trucks. And eventually I did a second trip back to Basra on tin trucks that we knew that on Sunday they arrived full of donkeys. They were swept out. Bundles of blankets were put in and cases of tin food. And they crammed you in there.
What was the smell like?
Oh, disgusting. And it wasn't, it was hot. The heat on these tin trucks was terrible. Now, modes of transport, they were really bad.
What were your feeding arrangements on this train journey?
You just had these tin foods, and then periodically along the line the train would stop, and there'd be some wogs there with a fire and made you a cup of tea.
What, so you bought the tea from them, from the Arabs?
No, it was provided. It was free. And you helped yourself to a tin of food. I don't think there was much variety. I can always remember this Harris's food. And it looked good. There was a coloured label on with pieces of meat and carrots and vegetables. And it was the most foul thing. A lot of airmen, this doesn't apply to all airmen, it applied to me. I never did like it. There was Harris's and there was McConaughey's. And if ever I was going on a trip where we used to have this, I used to buy a tin of sardines rather than that. I just did not like it. Well, then we arrived at Baghdad from Basra. We had a day in Aidi then. It wasn't Habaneh then. It was in Aidi, which was just outside Baghdad. And then we were flown. Now, there's a different schools of thought on this. I say we were flown in Vickers Valencias. My RAF friend at Horncastle says they were ridiculously Vimmies, but I still say they were Valencias. And we were flown to Mosul. Well, the reception we got there was just out of this world. There's no doubt about it. The red carpet, always humorous sight to it. I'll show you the photographs of it later. There were airmen there already that we had known, probably at Manston or somewhere like that, and they were told if they saw an airman who they'd known previously, they were to go to him and be responsible taking the naffy for a cup of tea. You were given an extra special dinner at night. You were given a concert at night. It was really wonderful, there's no doubt about it. You felt at home. And I still say that if I was asked for the happiest station I ever served on, it would be Mosul.
Was this because of the comradeship?
The comradeship was just out of this world. You had nothing outside mine. You had to make your own amusements. And there was one chap there, Oliver Cromwell, a leading aircraftsman. Well, if ever there was a Christian chap, he was it. He'd give his all for the airmen. He arranged all the concerts. He'd spend night after night playing records for us in the naffy. And that lad would kneel by his bed every night and say his prayers. And nobody jeered at him. It was an accepted thing. He really was a Christian chap, there's no doubt about it.
You mean he put his Christianity into practice?
He did, there's no doubt. The station commander, the first one, was a chap named Tanky Chamberlain, a good CO, but he was one of these cursing, swearing. He could use F and B's by the dozen, it didn't matter what company he was in. There was only about five ladies in Mosul, the British consul's wife, a doctor's wife, a solicitor's wife, and he saw little of them, but he used to play tennis with him, and he'd F and blind in front of them, it didn't matter. But he wasn't a bad chap. Well, then he left, and there was at that time, a squadron leader, Fiddermont. Well, he was the type of chap you could follow him up the road and say, well, there's a gentleman. It oozed from him somewhere or other. He was a marvellous fella, he really was. He'd keep you in touch with outside things like the Mussolini do in Italy and the El Selassie do, and he'd have you all in the dining room and he'd tell you all about that. And eventually, when he was coming home, he got us all in the dining room, and I remember one thing he said. He said, "Now I want you all to promise me that if ever you find yourself serving on a station, of which I am the station commander, I want you to walk up to me and say, 'Sir, I served under you at Mosul.'" Well, it was never my good fortune. But years after, I found his name while I was at the college in Who's Who. Air Vice Marshal Fiddiman retired, and he lived at Burnham-on-Sea, and I called to see him. Well, you've never known a chap make a fuss of, like, I'd served under him at Mosul, and he really was remarkable, there's no doubt about it. Unfortunately, he's dead now. Well, back to armoured cars. Our main thing was to keep tracks open, show a bit of strength in the villages, patrol pipelines, oil pipelines, a lot of training, and that was general. There were four sections of armoured cars in Iraq. There was one at Basra, two at Inadi, and one at Mosul. Each section, apart from other vehicles, kit-carrying vehicles and such like, had seven armoured cars. Six were out as part of the mobile section, and the seventh one was always in workshops. When that was overhauled, they brought it in, and you took another one out. Now, the history of armoured cars, and some of this is hearsay, there were Silver Ghosts, first made in 1905. The ones that we were using, and I wouldn't say that they were all of this year, was 1912. And I was still driving those cars as an NCO, or car commander in those days, in 1943.
These were Rolls-Royce made,
were they? Rolls-Royce. They were a marvellous car. Snags were broken half shafts and cracked sump plates. The sump was rather low, and there was no roads, you know. And if there was a load of rocks to go over, we went over them, no doubt about it. We didn't pick our way around. We went and we hit what was coming. Half shafts, at one time, we used to change them, and you had to split the differential because the half shaft went from the inside. I mean, nowadays, they go from the outside. And there were 52 nuts and differential. So we forgot that, and we used to have them. We'd find a spot where an aircraft would land, and we used to have a new actual complete flown out to us. A wonderful life, and I enjoyed it to the full.
You said that one of your roles was to keep tracks open. What did you mean by that?
Well, there's tracks leading to villages that if we didn't keep them open for emergency, which, as it happened, I never had while I was there, you find the tracks blocked up or something like that, so we...
Deliberately or not?
In cases, yes. Prior to my time, about 1926, there was a big uproar among the Kurds, and that's when it was necessary to keep these tracks open. We used to go out for a fortnight at a time, as that was our usual thing, and you didn't come back for that 14 days. Depending on how long you were to camp, if we were to camp for, say, 3 or 4 days, we'd put up tents and toilets. Other than that, if it was just one night, you slept with the sky as the roof.
So when you were keeping the tracks open, you were just moving the boulders out of the way? What?
Not necessarily. It was the track itself that we were interested in. If there was boulders on, then we would move them. But that wasn't quite the idea of it. It was just that you travelled over that track so that you knew where it was. You got to make yourself familiar with the countryside. As I say, if we were staying long, well, then we put up tents.